Dark Horse presents aliens. Deactivating language censorship. Warning. Spoilers activated.
Hit M for mature.
The story goes that after Rocky IV, the joke making its way through Hollywood was that Sylvester Stallone had finally upped the ante to such a degree that in the next movie he'd have to fight an alien. Neophyte screenwriting brothers Jim and John Thomas apparently took that as a challenge, although in their case it seemed to be more like Rambo versus the alien. And in fact, my understanding is that in the earlier drafts it was more of an inversion where it was simply Rambo versus a group of aliens. Also, owing to The Thing, these aliens were shapeshifters. They could assume various human forms, male, female, male, old, young. If you look to the novelization of the eventual film, it goes even further than that, where the alien could assume the form of any creature that it in any way come into contact with, even becoming a jackal from fur found from a jackal, could also take the possession of animals and use them for spying, could become immaterial, all kinds of nutty stuff. Eventually, a version of the screenplay made its way to Joel Silver, who, with the rising popularity of hybrid science fiction, horror, action movies, saw potential in the script and decided to give it the big budget treatment. The preferred star for this vehicle was Arnold Schwarzenegger, who had just starred in Joel Silver's hit Commando and had previously seen success with the Conan the Barbarian movies and most especially the Terminator. Schwarzenegger didn't initially like the script and asked for some rewrites to be done. Most especially, both he and his preferred director, John McTiernan, wanted to do something that recalled the old-time westerns. They didn't want the movie to hang on his character. He saw that character as being something he already played multiple times before and was very interested in doing it again. He wanted to have a whole team of mercenaries working with him. There would be colorful personalities, something along the lines of the Magnificent Seven or the Wild Bunch. And in fact, that was apparently the inspiration for the curtain call that you see at the end of the finished movie, where all the people who've died over the course of the film are reintroduced for one last nod to the audience. I doubt I need to recap the movie for anybody who'd listen to this podcast. So in brief, a group of mercenaries are sent into South America to recover some government officials who had been lost to a downed helicopter. The leader of the mercenaries is a man named Dutch, and the mission has been brought to him by a former compatriot, Dylan, who basically sells out his old friends to the government by keeping key information from them. Over the course of the mission, the mercenaries are hunted down one by one by an unseen force. These men are not only killed, but they are savage. They are scalped, laid, hung up like sides of meat. These men are the toughest of the tough. The actors cast were all bodybuilders or wrestlers. So these were peak physical specimens, guys who were known to be appearing in action movies as the toughest of the tough. And so a key part of the movie is seeing these machoest of macho men breaking down under these circumstances, facing an enemy that they cannot see, that they cannot fight, that completely overwhelms them, and whose extraordinary terrestrial firepower mean nothing to this force. Eventually, it is determined that the creature stalking these men is an alien. It is a hunter drawn to hot spots, both physically heat hot spots and combat wise. This being apparently targets, again, the toughest of the top, and picks them off for sport. With most of the crew dead, it ultimately comes down to a mano-e-predator fight between the mercenary leader Dutch and the alien. Relying on primitive booby traps and stealth, Dutch finally manages to overcome the alien, which triggers a failsafe device on its wrist that detonates an explosion that wipes out a good portion of the jungle. But ultimately, Dutch does appear to survive the encounter and
chopper!
To be rescued by U.S. forces. Again, the screenplay went through a number of evolutions, as did the predator creature. For starters, it was originally called the Hunter. The design has been described different ways. I've heard it called a grasshopper. Some people say that it had a giraffe neck with a dog's head, and it was cyclopean. Although Schwarzenegger said it looked more like it had a duck head. The original suit was worn by a then-unknown Jean-Claude Van Damme, but A, the suit was too hot for Mexico, where the movie was filming, and Van Damme was apparently passing passing out from the heat. It was also a cumbersome suit that did not allow him to do any martial arts and just failed to look intimidating. Plus, Jean-Claude is considerably shorter than most of the macho men that made up the mercenary group, so he just didn't appear to be the level of terrifying foe that one would expect from a movie of this type. Van Damme was eventually let go, and the creature was redesigned by Sam Winston Studio. Schwarzenegger most likely brought Winston in, having had good experiences with him on The Terminator. Speaking of people associated with that franchise and with Schwarzenegger, the new design of the Predator involving mandibles was suggested by Jim Cameron, who was on a flight with Winston while he was working on the new design. Kevin Peter Hall, standing over 7 feet tall, was much more fearsome as the new Predator. The creature was largely humanoid, but paler than average, with spots, crab face, and long black claws. Originally, he was going to bleed orange blood, but it just wasn't striking enough on film. So somebody finally came up with the idea of mixing the liquid contained in glow sticks, the chemical, with jelly, I believe, and that was used to have the fluorescent green blood that we see in the film. Besides cool alien melee weapons, the Predator uses a shoulder-mounted laser cannon and can approximate invisibility by appearing to warp light around itself to resemble its environment. It's an iconic effect that was produced by shooting the same scenery twice with two different lenses, and with one of the filmings, you would have a actor in an all-red outfit to contrast against the background to give it the shape, but then that would be blurred out for a second pass at the same imagery with a wider lens that would sort of warp the image. While typically portrayed as hunters that are just higher up in the food chain than humanity, if you go back to the novelization and perhaps earlier screenplays, the Predators were also scientists who were studying humans. They were essentially vivisectionists. Most of the film was shot before the final Predator design was in. There's actually an 8-month gap between what you see with Arnold Schwarzenegger as part of a group and the Schwarzenegger scenes where he's solo against the Predator. The film was a major success. It was number one at the box office. I think it was the number two movie of 1987 after Beverly Hills Cop 2. It made nearly $100 million off of a roughly $15 to $18 million budget, many, many times return. So a sequel was all but guaranteed. However, no scripts were ever drafted to Schwarzenegger's liking, and the film ultimately went into production at around the same time as Schwarzenegger was busy doing Terminator 2 Judgment Day, thus ending Schwarzenegger's involvement with the entire Predator franchise. This is despite his character figuring heavily into the initial drafts for the sequel. Excerpt from Amazing Heroes Preview Special number 157, cover dated January 15th, 1989, Predator, written by Mark Verheiden, illustrated by Chris Warner, edited by Randy Stradley. 4-issue miniseries, 48 full-color pages, $3.50, prestige format, monthly from Dark Horse Comics. Third of Dark Horse's movie comics after Godzilla and Aliens, Predator will be a sequel continuation of the 1988 hit movie starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. In the original film, Arnold's character was named Dutch Schaefer. In the comic, readers will meet his big brother, and we do mean big, Schaefer, a New York City cop. Schaefer's newest case involves a series of grisly murders in the city's hottest summer ever. Of course, the murderers are the Predators, says writer Mark Verheiden. But the big questions are, why had they come to New York, and what do they want from us? The whole series revolves around Schaefer trying to figure out what they want and how to stop them before they kill more people. Schaefer will be assisted by a band of bloodthirsty renegade gangs, young terrorists who have effectively taken over the city. Their members are being killed, however, as the Predators enjoy the hunt of going after the strong animal, and the gang members seem the strongest the city has to offer. The rest of the story is still in formulative stages at press time, but Verheiden promises a lot of action, perhaps more so than what was in the movie. Verheiden again teams up with ex-American penciler Chris Warner for this full-color prestige format book. Predator will probably appear in April. The miniseries ran roughly parallel with the 1989 full-color Alien series. Even before that first issue has come out, though, there's a blurb in Amazing Heroes number 169, cover dated July 15th, 1989. Hey man, if an alien fought a Predator, which one would win? Comic-Con small talk becomes reality this fall as the Battle of the Century kicks off in Dark Horse Presents number 36, due October 31st. Voracious aliens and cold-blooded predators mix it up on a far-off world, with a colony of hapless humans thrown in for good measure. Following the Dark Horse Presents prologue, the battle will move to its own miniseries, beginning in November. Creative credits go to Randy Stradley and movie designer Philip Norwood, The Abyss, RoboCop 2. The very next issue of Amazing Heroes was another preview special, number 170, which goes into more detail. At this point, the format for Predator has been changed to 32 full-color pages at 225 each. Beginning in June, the Predator miniseries takes place in New York City, where Dutch Schaefer's, the Arnold Schwarzenegger character from the movie, Big Brother, Schaefer, is a veteran police detective. Investigating an especially grisly series of murders, Schaefer is warned off the case by General Phillips, Dutch's former commanding officer, also from the movie. Phillips doesn't say much, says writer Mark Verheiden, but it's clear that whatever's offing New York citizens, was also somehow involved in his brother's disappearance. In the course of his private investigations, Schaefer meets face-to-face with a fearsome predator and is almost killed. After the battle, Schaefer discovers that Phillips has also mysteriously disappeared, so Schaefer is forced to retrace Dutch's steps in the jungles outside Columbia for some kind of clue. There he learns the legend of the mysterious predator and some surprising, sinister truths. Before it's all over, says Verheiden, speaking of the comic's action-adventure, New York will be in desperate need of urban renewal. If Predator is successful, there's been talk of doing another solo series based on the characters. Until then, check out Predator and the two-part Aliens vs. Predator series. See preview. There's some ambiguity about the actual release date for Predator number one. Mike's Amazing World of Comics tries to assert it as May 1st, 1989, with a June 1989 cover date, but the inside front cover of the actual issue states September of the same year. And given that those Amazing Heroes articles are still referring to Predator in the future sense as of July, seems pretty likely. The story is set in the near future, at least at some point past 1991. New York is caught in the grip of a hellacious heat wave, prompting people to murder one another just from the heat itself. Our point of view character is actually a slightly overweight, balding, mustachioed man named Rashi, who I assume is named after David Rashi, the actor who portrayed Sledgehammer in the Dirty Harry parodying sitcom on ABC from a couple of years prior to this series.
Trust me, I know what I'm doing.
Rashi is the partner of Schaefer and kind of his hype man as well. The first issue actually spends several pages obscuring the face of Schaefer, so you don't quite know who he is, what he's supposed to look like. The scene shifts to gangbangers in New York City being hunted by the predators, being classic style comic book gangsters. The individual gangs are multicultural and wear war paint. They're seriously the warriors. We finally get to see Schaefer's face around page 10 as he's cocking his looks like a Colt. In the broadest sense, he looks like Schwarzenegger. He's a tall, muscular guy. In the face, though, I'd say he's a little bit more of a Brian Bosworth. Schaefer and Rashi finds numerous gang members ritualistically murdered, referred to as an equal opportunity massacre since it's both sides. The biggest, toughest, craziest gangbanger, Carr, manages to survive, but rather than cooperating with police, he escapes. Schaefer's commanding officer shows up and basically says that he stepped in at this time, that he went against orders and broke a seal around the building that had been ordered. That's where we're introduced to General Phillips, and when you start to know that there are big muckety mucks in the government or the military that are involved in this investigation, which is why they want Schaefer out. Cut to a sequence in a subway where the Predator is hunting commuters who happen to be very well armed. Schaefer and Rashi investigate the subway killings. They're again confronted by their commanding officer, McComb, and they all have a run-in with Phillips, and that's when Schaefer learns that Phillips knew his brother Dutch. Phillips then takes the cops out for drinks and explains that he can't tell him what happened to Dutch, but he owes it to his buddy Dutch to tell Schaefer to back off. It's better this way. Not that he's going to listen. Schaefer returns to the scene of the gangland massacre where he has a run-in with the Predator. Schaefer manages to bash the Predator with a wooden plank, knocking off his helmet. The Predator responds by quoting one of the gangbangers who had mistaken him for a trick-or-treater earlier, saying, "Let's give him some candy," before defenestrating Schaefer. If all of this sounds familiar, it's probably because you saw the movie Predator 2. As mentioned, there was some trouble with the production of a screenplay for the sequel to Predator, especially once Schwarzenegger was not available and a new direction seemed to be called for. At some point, Mark Verheiden was summoned by Silver's production company to have a meeting with the screenwriters. Only one issue of the Predator comic had been released up to that point, and curiously, the premise and numerous key points, pretty much all the key points of the first issue of the Predator comic, in some way, shape, or form, turn up in the Predator sequel screenplay. My understanding is that Predator number one was the only issue released during the screenplay writing process, and that's where the two stories diverge. Now, curiously, Predator number two also states that it was released in September of 1989. I suspect that that had more to do with a recycling of the template for the inner cover. Most probably, they were just reusing the same basic components and they missed changing the date. Based on looking at the various issues of Amazing Heroes, it looks like issues of Predator were coming out roughly on the same rate as issues of the 1989 Aliens comic, often on the same month, at least as far as the listings in Amazing Heroes, which means you're looking at months-long delays in between issues, which would also help to explain why none of the contents of issues 2, 3, and 4 really had an impact on the Predator 2 movie. Issue number 2 starts with Schaefer managing to save himself from falling by grabbing onto conveniently hanging clotheslines between buildings. Schaefer has also been tagged with a metal disc. Apparently, that's to allow the Predator to track him for future usage. He's got some healing up to do, so around actually carries a chunk of the story. As he goes home to his wife and has explained why he keeps doing renegade cop bullshit, the two cops continue to have angry confrontations with their boss. McComb, I have to point out that McComb is basically the only African-American person in this entire series that isn't a gangbanger, and he's depicted as a coward, a paper pusher, a guy who's completely cowed by City Hall and by the government. It's a little gross, a little weird, and it contrasts poorly against the motion picture. Another thing that's weird is, despite living on a cop's salary, Schaefer's able to come up with a scratch to fly down to South America with no notice. He makes his way to Colombia. He manages to find someone who could guide him to where his brother Dutch had disappeared. He sees the great big hole in the jungle created by the Predator Dutch Nation, and in the same space, he himself is ultimately hunted by the Predator, who is tracking him by the metal disc. I'm going to tell you now, and I'll say it in no uncertain terms, Big Brother Schaefer is a badder motherfucker than Dutch. That's made clear throughout the comic books. For starters, this is his second confrontation with the Predator. He kills this Predator. He stabs it in the gut. He smashes a salt shaker in its eyes. He makes fun of his hair, saying that Rasta shit's been out for years. And then finally, he leaves him impaled on a log with his neon green blood flowing freely. So that's the last we're going to see of that Predator in this miniseries. And Schaefer figures he's set. He's done the job he set out for. He killed the alien that did whatever he did to his brother. Sadly mistaken, because Phillips has been following him this entire time and notes at the end of the issue, oh my god, Perkins, Radio Washington, scramble everything, we're going on full combat alert, and get me the president, the shit's about to hit the fan. Meanwhile, has this been going on? The December 1989 cover date of Amazing Heroes number 174 has a small blurb noting that another Dark Horse News, the Aliens vs. Predator miniseries has been extended to 4 issues with the final part released in February. Jump to February 1990, issue number 176, and there's a whole section on Dark Horse graphic albums to be released in bookstores. Graphic novel publisher NBM has signed an agreement with Dark Horse Comics to release Dark Horse's new line of graphic novels to general bookstores. Among those books to be sold in major bookstore chains are Aliens, Predator, and collections of work in color from Dark Horse's Cheval Noir book. NBM publisher Terry Nantier is very excited by the sales prospects for the Dark Horse books. I look forward to getting the Dark Horse books out there. The Aliens and Predator books should be stars for us this spring. Another Dark Horse news, The American has been canceled with issue number 8, and its color special was canceled without being published. However, there's a good chance that the character will be revived. Meanwhile, May's American special by Mark Verheiden and Doug Braithwaite will conclude all of the outstanding American plot lines. The 32-page black and white comic will cost $2.25. Also, look for a new American story by this creative team in Atomica Press's A1 number 3. Predator number 3 featured an interior date of November 1989, and now credits the art primarily to Ron Randall with Chris Warner. Back in New York, Rashi is playing around with the Predator helmet that was retrieved during the first battle between Schaefer and the Predator. And looking out over the city, he sees a number of alien spacecraft, very much shades of They Live, the John Carpenter film. Apparently, these aircraft are invisible to the naked eye, but can be seen through the Predator helmet. Back in Colombia, Schaefer's victory lap is cut short by a Colombians with ties to the gangs that he was fighting in New York, who are looking for revenge against him. After being captured, he manages to break free while severely brutally killing some Colombians, and then he's pretty swiftly aided by additional Predators who begin gunning down the Colombians in search of Schaefer. Schaefer eventually runs into General Phillips, who helps get him out of Colombia. Back in New York, Rashi is kidnapped by quote-unquote accountants with the IRS, who are actually men in black, essentially. He has to get loose of them, make his way to a police storage unit, and get a hold of some automatic machine guns to help him go save his buddy Schaefer and to combat the alien menaces that he's detected. Somehow, Schaefer and Phillips manage to fly a helicopter from Colombia to New York City, where it turns out that Phillips is intent on turning Schaefer over to the Predators, who they have some sort of diplomatic relations with, and because of Schaefer's having killed one of the Predators, they apparently created some sort of snafu that's going to be corrected by turning him over to them. Instead, Schaefer clobbers Phillips, beats up some more military officers, gets a hold of their guns, and says, "Put on some music and open the bar, boys, it's party time." I'm assuming that's when we were supposed to cue the Little Richard. Gonna tell Aunt Mary about up the joint. The candy has the music, but he has a lot of fun. Oh, baby. Yes, baby. Woo, baby. Yeah, he's so fun tonight. Yeah. Well, long talk, sad to see. Give a speech, you guys. Everything that up the joint need, oh, baby. Yes, baby. Woo, baby. Having some fun tonight. hope the November date in number 3 was incorrect, because number 4 has an interior date of March 1990, once again by Ron Randall and Chris Warner. Now, I'm not sure how the breakdown worked. I don't know if Ron Randall was providing layouts and Chris Warner finishes, or if Ron Randall intentionally altered his style to better resemble Chris Warner's. But despite having two artists that wouldn't normally be mistaken for one another, the art is surprisingly consistent. So 4 begins with Rashi breaking down the door at the top of the building where the helicopter had landed, and Schaefer saying, "Jesus, Rashi, where have you been?" After catching one another up on things, Schaefer goes after the gangbanger Carr, wrestles with him, basically convinces him to team up to go after the Predator, since they're both essentially targets of the Predator by having been survivors of previous encounters. A new Predator clad in red shows up and begins fighting the both of them. As it happens, Rashi has secured a bazooka from the storage locker and blows out the wall of a tenement. As best I can tell, that's another Predator dead, and that cues an all-out war with the Predators blowing up whole chunks of New York City. Not on the ground, by the way. Their ships are blasting like laser blasts and shit. But again, the only people who can see what's causing this are Schaefer, Rashi, and Carr, since they have Predator helmets that allows them to see the They Live ships. So not unlike the Aliens adaptations, is another instance of Verheiden seemingly deriving inspiration from other movies of recent vintage while doing weird shit that kind of breaks with the formula of the movies he's adapting. So ultimately, Carr manages to get together an army of gangsters, plus the police show up, although they're not friendly disposed toward Schaefer or Rashi. Everybody's fighting everybody. McComb gets blasted by one of the Predators. He gets a laser to the head.
Over my dead body.
I guess there are still a few black gangbangers running around, so representation. The military gets involved. They're blowing up fire hydrants because that's short-circuiting the Predator's equipment, allowing them to be seen and shot at. The Predators have a tendency to run around with armor of primary colors, red, orange, greens, just to tell them apart. They're getting mowed down left and right, mostly by the gangsters. This miniseries would be strong evidence against the Predators being tougher than aliens, given how easily and often they're mowed down by conventional weapons, not necessarily the most highly trained of individuals wielding them. And finally, hostilities end because of the sudden onset of a rainstorm. Summer's over, it's too cool for the Predators, so they all pick up and leave. And also, the little tracking device that was planted on Schaefer pops off. By the way, in case you're wondering, Schaefer is the family name. I don't think the Dutch is ever identified by his proper name in the movie, but the novelization identifies him as Major Alan Schaefer, and the protagonist of the Dark Horse comics is his brother John Schaefer. So, unsurprisingly, the miniseries was a success. While initially called simply Predator, occasionally subtitled The Heat, when it was collected in September of 1990, it was redubbed Concrete Jungle and given a cover by Aliens artist Din Bovase. The series was released internationally, Britain, Germany. A deluxe hardcover was released in 1991. Possibly as a stopgap during the seemingly lengthy spaces between issues. A new short story was drafted for Dark Horse Presents, issue number 46, dated December 1990. The story was retroactively titled God's Truth, written by John Arcudi, penciled by Rob Walton, inked by Armando Gill. The issue featured a drawn cover by Dave Dorman, and to my knowledge has never been produced in color. Even when reprinted in the Predator Omnibus in 2008, it was done in black and white. The story is told in flash back, but is set in August of 1926 in the Florida Everglades. It appears to be told in the perspective of an escaped convict who's being hunted through the swamps. The deputies hunting for the convict are picked off one by one by a Predator. Ultimately, one of the deputies ends up strung up by the leg in a trap and is disarmed. He'd fought in the war, World War I, and did not relish pursuing this individual. The prisoner threatens him with a shotgun, seems like he's planning to kill him. The Predator ends up killing the escapee, and it turns out the story is actually being told from the perspective of the last surviving deputy, who is at the mercy of the Predator, who quotes back a line from one of the deputies spoken earlier, "'Tain't no sport in him." He survives by being disarmed and is now telling that story to his grandchildren. Meanwhile, the May 1990 cover dated Amazing Heroes number 179 offered the blurb, "Dark Horse to release Give Me Liberty, two new Alien series, Concrete Odd Job. Two big Aliens books are due out in June. The long-delayed Aliens vs. Predator Predator by Stradley, Norwood, and Story is finally out in June, along with Aliens Earth Wars, a four-issue color series by Mark Verheiden and Sam Keith, which shows what happens to Newt and Hicks when an old comrade shows up to help them rid the planet of the aliens. Each issue retails for $2.50. The following issue, number 180, notes the release of Aliens Earth War number 1 and Aliens vs. Predator number 1. There's also a blurb from Dark Horse, Miller's Hardboiled Aliens vs. Predator number 0. As if Give Me Liberty and the RoboCop 2 movie weren't enough, Frank Miller continues to surface in the public eye as the writer of Hardboiled, a four-issue color series about the world as seen through the eyes of a psychotic cyborg. Jeff Darrow will be the artist of the bi-monthly $6.95 series, which will be printed at graphic novel size. There's another blurb for an adaptation of Duckman. And then, as a companion to the new Aliens vs. Predator series, the prequel series from Dark Horse is being collected as Aliens vs. Predator number 0, a black and white $1.95 comic by Randy Stradley and Philip Norwood, with a new cover by Mike Mignola. Also, the original Predator series by Mark Verheiden and Chris Warner will be collected in a $12.95 color trade paperback. And speaking of Aliens, the oversized deluxe version of Biomechanics by the original Alien designer H.R. Giger is available for $100 for those who can afford it. Warning though, the accompanying text is in German, but with Giger, the pictures speak for themselves. I think with these interstitials, I'm hopefully making clear two things that I think were baked into the Dark Horse Comics Predator adaptation. Number one, that it seems like Predator was an expansion of the Aliens line. It seems like they had the great success of the first two Aliens miniseries. They were wanting to expand their relationship with 20th Century Fox, hence the big comic book, the Abyss adaptation. But most especially, you had Predator, which seemed very much of a piece with Aliens, and the concept of those two properties interacting was present in Dark Horse adaptation almost from the very beginning. So, as mentioned in the Amazing Heroes blurb earlier, it seems like the comic book may have come into existence specifically to interact with Aliens. It's so early in the development of the series. It's being talked about as a done deal, as something that's going to be produced while the first Predator miniseries is coming out. A lot of Hollywood types dismiss as a novelty the concept of mixing the Aliens versus the Predators, but this was such a core centerpiece of the Dark Horse adaptation that it's hard for me to believe that Dark Horse and Hollywood didn't have some ideas along these same lines, that these two properties should always feed off of each other. I mean, literally, the movie is a year or two old, and they're already doing comic books intermixing these two properties. The other thing that seems to be baked in from the very beginning is the concepts from the Predator miniseries heavily influencing the actual movie sequel. The comics adaptation of Predator 2 is roughly the fourth venture between Dark Horse and 20th Century Fox with this property. Think about it. You've got the original miniseries. You've got the one-off story in Dark Horse Presents. You've got the Aliens vs. Predator build-up and actual miniseries. And then you've got the movie adaptation. That's a lot of stuff all coming at you in a very short period of time for it to be interlaced with one another. And again, sticking to the basics, especially since the adaptation is only two issues. Cover date is February 1991. The script is credited to Franz Hinkle, obviously adapting the screenplay by Jim and John Thomas. Pencils by Dan Barry, inks by Randy Amberlin. Full color. We see the Lieutenant Harrigan character as portrayed by Danny Glover in the film. The movie starts out with a gun battle between two gangs and the police. This is set in 1997 Los Angeles, so 10 years after the first film. It's one of those 15 minutes in the future kind of things, as noted by the screenwriters, taking a page from Max Headroom. It's basically the present with some flourishes to let you know that some things have changed. Gang warfare in Los Angeles is even worse. They made a point of mentioning that the city has been overrun by minorities, which is a really weird phrasing, but given that there are actual heavy representations within this miniseries, that if anything, white people are in the minority in this motion picture versus the near complete absence of anybody of color in the comic books, I have to say it's a little improvement. And so the renegade hero cop commandeers a squad car, knocks off the door so that he can shoot while hanging out the door while driving the car to protect other cops from gangster gunfire, and then he manages to mow down a bunch of gangbangers. Meanwhile, inside the building that they're holed up in, the Predator comes down and starts killing them left and right. If you've seen the movie, there's this great bit where the lead Latino gangster, El Scorpio, I think he's called, grabs like a literal handful of cocaine and starts sniffing it. It's gloriously 80s, even though it was produced in the 90s. Now, the cops are under orders to not enter the building. Apparently, there are some big muckety mucks who are coming to to investigate the scene. They don't want the cops involved. It's actually the right call because the cops don't do anything good while they're in the building. Some cops end up getting killed as a result, but they don't manage to save anybody seemingly. And again, you can see the parallel between the comic book and the movie. Ultimately, the hero cop is on top of the building and he's pursuing El Scorpio. Scorpio draws seemingly on the cop, but is actually drawing on the outline of a predator that's stalking him. But he gets gunned down by the cop and goes off the roof, falls to his death. The cops discover all the bodies within. They've been ritualistically murdered, but in this case, that's actually not completely unexpected because one of the warring gangs, the Jamaican voodoo gang, actually does this sort of thing anyway. The problem is they can't figure out how they managed to do it without using any machine guns themselves. It was all done with melee weapons, and these guys were all killed and hung up without any of the cops seeing any of them enter or exit. Lieutenant Harrigan keeps having problems with his captain, Pilgrim, and the higher up, I think the chief of police, Heineman, has the most in common with McComb from the miniseries. But in the movie, he's portrayed by Robert Davi, who is also in Die Hard, which was directed by John McTiernan. There's going to be a pattern. If you haven't already noticed, Danny Glover is basically playing Riggs instead of Murtaugh in this movie. We're introduced to the government muckety-muck that's calling the shots, Keyes, who is played by Gary Busey, who played the main bad guy in Lethal Weapon, the film series that Danny Glover is most famous for being in. Harrington has a small inner circle that he works with that includes Detective Danny Archuleta. They just call him Danny Boy all the time. He's played by Ruben Blades. And then you have Detective Leona Cantrell, who's played by Maria Conchita Alonso, who was perhaps best known for co-starring with Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Running Man. She's playing a literal ball-busting Latina, very similar to Vasquez, against the new Detective Jerry Lambert, aka the Lone Ranger, a big mouth, cocky jerk played by Bill Paxton, who you may remember was Hudson in Aliens. So once again, you have the dynamic of Hudson and Vasquez vibing badly off of one another. Meanwhile, there's more ritualistic killings. Harrington continues to step on Keyes' toes, just as happened in Predator comic book number one. Danny goes back to the scene of one of the massacres to investigate. He finds one of the Predator's tools. Unfortunately, he also finds the Predator and his death. So now the lieutenant isn't just an OCD compelled, violent, rampaging cop renegade. Now it's personal. You also get to see him sock Morton Downey Jr. pretending to be a grass, opportunistic, sensationalistic journalist. Harrington also keeps having run-ins with Gary Busey's character, who also has a lackey played by Adam Baldwin. So you'll notice that basically everybody that Harrington has a problem with became a hard right asshole in real life. I don't know if there's any sort of weird subtext to that. Harrington eventually arranges a meet with the main voodoo priest guy, who basically explains to him that they're fighting a creature from the beyond. He thinks it's some sort of a voodoo monster, and he ultimately gets killed by the predator once the cop leaves. If you've seen the movie, there's a cool sequence where it looks like the voodoo guy is screaming about ready to fight, but it turns out it's actually his severed head in that pose being carried off by the predator. Randomly, issue number 2 of the Predator adaptation is penciled by Mark Bright. We get a sequence where the predator is visiting the grave of Danny Boy, and he runs into a little kid who's got a toy Uzi, and he's able to recognize that the boy is not a real threat. He also records the boy asking him, "Want some candy?" Again, sounds very familiar. There's this weird cat and mouse thing where the predator leaves Danny Boy's necklace hanging from a tree. He's taunting the lieutenant. This seems like a much more personal affair than what we had in the first Predator movie. Although it should be noted that there was an effort made to make this predator appear different from the one in the first movie. They gave him some tribal tattoos. They changed his face somewhat. And I think that it's been mentioned that the actor who this is the same actor from the first movie, tried to give him a different kind of style. And so this is supposed to be a younger, cockier, I guess more asshole-y predator. And so once again, there's a sequence on a subway train in Los Angeles involving armed commuters being mowed down by the predator. This is where Not Hudson buys it, R.I.P. Bill Paxton. And Maria Conchita Alonso's character is spared because the predator is able to detect a fetal heartbeat within her abdomen, demonstrating an honor system within the predators. Lieutenant Herring pursues the predator, but is eventually sidelined by the government spooks. It turns out that Keyes has been working with a top secret operation that is trying to acquire the predator's technology. So they don't want to kill the predator. They want to freeze it and then study it. He has a big elaborate plan that he thinks is going to work, where they've tracked the predator to a slaughterhouse. They make a point of noting that this is where the predator feeds, so apparently the predator does not eat humans in differentiation with the aliens. I'm still not sure if we've ever firmly established that the aliens actually eat humans rather than use them as part of their life cycle, but I think it's a safe assumption based on the early comic adaptation that Walt Simonson and Archie Goodwin did, but also just in the way that they cannibalize all the parts of human beings and any other animals they come into contact with. But apparently the predators do not eat human meat based on this movie and the comic adaptation of such. So they've got this convoluted scheme where they're going to freeze the predator. It doesn't work out. They assume too much about the predator's ability to adapt to varying conditions. And also they're all running around dressed like Pop-Tarts. It was one of the many things that I reacted negatively to when I saw the movie the first time. Similarly, there's a sequence where Adam Baldwin's character is absolutely doing a Lieutenant Gorman, where he's watching the people get mowed down on video monitors and not doing anything, despite not Ripley shaking him and telling him to do something. And when he doesn't do something, then Lieutenant Herring breaks loose and tries to save the men. He's actually himself saved by the Gary Busey character before Busey is killed by that cool boomerang thing that's introduced in this movie, which eventually is taken in by the Danny Glover character. I'm not going to bother with his name anymore. Danny Glover manages to shoot the predator repeatedly with a shotgun at close range, which gets him bleeding pretty good. It seems to disable him, but then the predator recovers. Danny Glover and his ridiculously compensatory giant chrome hand cannon continue to go up against the predator. He eventually ends up dangling off the side of the building. They did this whole thing they set up where he's got like a vertigo situation. It's bad enough that Danny Glover in no way is the big macho man that Arnold Schwarzenegger would be, but they also had to saddle him with the fear of heights that they play with a lot toward the end of the movie. I think they were trying to go for a Bruce Willis, John McClane thing with giving him more human qualities, but then he's also the harsh, renegade, Dirty Harry type cop. The two don't really mesh that well. While they're dangling off the building, the Danny Glover character manages to get a hold of the cool boomerang thing and chop off the predator's arm before it has a chance to activate its self-destruct device. It eventually tracks the creature to its spaceship, which is conveniently located in, I guess, a sewer or a subway tunnel. It's not super clear. We get to see the insides of the predator ship, which includes a xenomorph skull. This is present in the movie, so again, baked into the motherfucking movie is a connection between aliens and the predators. There's another one of these proto-shared cinematic universes like the Universal Monsters that predates Marvel Studios. In a truly bullshit move, the Danny Glover character manages to kill the predator, and then a bunch of other predators show up to carry away their dead, and seemingly as a show of respect, they toss the cop a revolutionary era flintlock to show they've been coming to Earth during hot seasons over and over again, and then they fly the fuck off. The end. At one point, I had considered inviting Fryhole to help cover Predator 2, specifically because I was talking shit about the movie and he said he would slap me and I was wanting to take him up on the dare. I saw Predator 2 on, I believe, home video in the early 90s, and I disliked it a great deal. I have not watched it again in the decades since, up till tonight as I'm recording this podcast. Having rewatched it, I could appreciate it more. A lot of things I hated about the first time I saw it are more amusing to me now because they're taking all these character and character types and actors from movies that are similar to the Predator franchise and putting them all into a Predator sequel. At the time, I thought that was really cynical and cheap, but now it's kind of nice to have all these actors together playing somewhat similar characters. I do have to say that as much as I love Bill Paxton, I still can't stand his character in that movie. I think it's a rather grating performance. But as it happens, I'd read an interview with Paxton in an issue of Fangoria from sometime around this time period where he was talking up the character he was playing. He really liked that he had his own catchphrase, dead solid, perfect, and yada yada. So at least Paxton was excited for the character. What I did like watching it again is that it's a fast-moving movie. Throughout the first hour, it's just beat after beat after beat. They've got full frontal nudity. They've got graphic violence. You can see where this movie was originally rated NC-17, the equivalent of an X rating, and they had to chop it down to barely get it in as an R. I love that it's a barely R movie. Directing is actually pretty solid. Some really nice camera angles, very well designed, very iconic framing and such. Stephen Hopkins had done one of the lesser Nightmare on Elm Street movies, although of course as that franchise continued, not unlike the Predator franchise, what was shit in the 80s and 90s looks good by comparison to the later sequels. And he went on to do some okay stuff like Judgment Night. The movie, by the way, was made for like $20 to $30 million, made about 50 $7 million, so didn't quite double its budget, so certainly nowhere near the multiplier that the first Predator had, which is probably part of the reason why it's looked upon so poorly. But also, let's be honest, there are fewer Rex Reeds in the world reviewing these type of movies, so based on how terrible the later movies are, Predator 2 looks a lot better by comparison, and it's fairly fun. I will say that after that first hour, especially as the focus becomes more and more on the Danny Glover character, tedious. I mean, it's not terrible, it's watchable, the whole movie's watchable, but that last 45 minutes, I just keep looking at my watch low and how can this thing still be going on? How are they managed to stretch this thing out so much? I personally like Danny Glover. I think he's a great actor. I think he's really poorly cast in this movie, besides the fact that he just cannot have the physical presence of an Arnold Schwarzenegger. The fact is, even though he's playing the renegade cop, his mannerisms don't really convey that very well. I remember when I first saw the movie, I just couldn't stop seeing him as Murtaugh. I'm a little bit more mature. I'm older now, probably, than he was when he was making the movie, so that probably gives me a little bit more perspective. I can see his relative youth. He's not playing a 50-something as he was in the Lethal Weapon movies. He's in his 30s or so, but he gets into like shouting matches with his boss, right? And it's like, well, the rule number one is that the cool renegade cop doesn't respect his CO. He doesn't respect these cops that are by the book. So he's going to have a sarcastic quip. He's not going to get worked up enough to get into a shouting match because he's just too damn cool for that. And those guys are too much beneath him. There are too many shots of him looking fearful and unsure. He just doesn't really dress for it. He's kind of got grandpa pants on and he's got kind of a dopey hat for a good chunk of the movie. He definitely looks like grandpa trying to be the tough guy, even though he's a relatively young man from my own perspective at these days. He just doesn't sell the renegade cop very well, but he's still a good actor. The whole cast is still pretty solid. I would say the only weak link is really Bill Paxton because the character is so grating as written, but also as performed. But he's actually fairly capable in his job for the most part, so he's more useful ultimately than Hudson was, but not as charming, unfortunately. So Predator 2, dumb fun. I've been hard on it. I don't foresee seeing it again without there being a motivation like a podcast, but I didn't hate watching it. I've definitely, if I had to watch Predator 2 or Dune again, I would definitely rather watch Predator 2, and I'll be looking at my watch a lot less. The comic adaptation is okay. It's rather perfunctory. The artists for the issues are not anybody that's going to get anybody excited, and they're not really necessarily geared toward that sex and violence that you're looking for. I mean, they showed the naked lady from the drug cartel torture sequence, but there's no sex appeal. This is not a heavy metal situation here. The adaptation is pretty missable. The next original Predator comic is Cold War, once again by Mark Verheiden, and joined by Ron Randall doing the entire pencil this time. Inks are by Steve Mitchell. Ron Randall can hit a deadline, so September, October, November, December 1991. In case you missed the frame of reference, that means that the Predator 2 movie and adaptation are out in the summer of this year, and we're now in the fall and winter of the year. Counter to the near future narrative of Concrete Jungle, this sequel, direct sequel to the first Predator miniseries, is set in northern Siberia in 1990. Essentially, a ship full of Predators crash land in the frigid wasteland of the former USSR. Was it former by then? I'm not so sure it was former. I think it might have still been reactive. That was 89, right? Yeah. Fortuitous timing. This takes place before the fall of the USSR, so this was sort of like their last hurrah, this Predator miniseries. So anyway, these Predators don't like the cold. They don't want to be in this climate at all. It would have been kind of interesting for them to just fucking not function at all, but somehow they're still predatoring to their heart's content, except that they need a major heat source, and they find that by making their way to some Soviet power station or nuclear station, some shit like that. Anyway, one of the major characters is Lieutenant Ligachev, who I'm going to just call Nikita. She's a hot Russian commander type lady. She had apparently had some sort of a fucked up situation, so this was like her being consigned and then trying to find some sort of redemption arc in this outback shithole. Well, all this fucking around with nuclear research attracts the attention of General Phillips and Washington, D.C. There is an escalation because there are elements in the U.S. that think that there's a nuclear ramp up with the Soviets, but General Phillips recognizes that no, it's a situation involving the Predators, and he wants to be in on that shit. Then we flash over to Blue Creek, Oregon. And so apparently after all the shit went down in New York City, Rashi fucked off to, you know, somewhere in the boonies of where Dark Horse Comics were actually produced and became a local sheriff. He basically had promised his wife he was done with all that stupid bullshit, but he still has this fixation on his brother cop Dutch. Oh, sorry, no, it's brother cop Schaefer. Schaefer is somehow still managing the function in New York City after all that shitty bull. I guess because he's working undercover with a wire, but the dude is built like a brick shithouse, so how are you not able to spot this guy, you know, immediately? Anyway, he is made almost immediately. He almost gets himself killed, but he's essentially rescued by government spooks who want him to go in and help him deal with this predator situation in the USSR on a covert mission where they need plausible deniability, because otherwise they're gonna start World War III by fucking around with this shit. In another instance of the movies and comics feeding one another, all of the new toys that were introduced to Predator 2 are also featured in this miniseries. The spear, the boomerang thing, the net gun that bores into the flesh like some kind of Cenobite bullshit. So General Phillips has basically his own Colonial Marines that are going to team up with Schaefer to invade the USSR. Schaefer is extremely antagonistic with these guys, so they're basically ready to kill him before they even get inside. I think it's important to note a key difference between Dutch and John. Having recently rewatched the movie Predator, Dutch is, for the most part, a slightly more taciturn version of your typical Arnie character. So he's a little bit smug, but good-natured, quick with a quip when it's appropriate, but obviously as things get more dire, he, you know, doesn't pull that shit so much. His brother is a fucking asshole. No jokes, no sense of humor, stick up his ass, like no fun at all. Cynical, negative. Something that's referenced in this miniseries is that when he inevitably teams up with the Russian chick, she finds his pessimism to be a real turnoff, because she's a person who's a little bit more of an optimist, somebody who's a little bit more positive about what she's capable of and yada yada. But Schaefer is just a full-on dick. He's lousy to everybody. You know, he just treats everybody like dirt. All he cares about is finding out what happened to his brother or shooting whoever he wants to shoot. He doesn't really have much in the way of a personality beyond that. Renegade cop Marty Sue. Schaefer has been kidnapped. Word makes its way to Rashi. So even though his wife is less than understanding, the dude on his Oregon sheriff's budget manages to first get a plane to New York City, and then somehow through convoluted means actually manages to make his way to Soviet Russia. Again, this guy's a sheriff in Oregon, but he's got such a strong bromance with Schaefer that he's going to make his way to Russia to save his pal. Siberia specifically, okay? So anyway, Nikita's all busted up because she had been accepted by the guys working at this nuclear facility. She had to win her way back after these failings that she'd had, and now all these guys have been killed by the predators, and so this is personal for us hurt too. Meanwhile, like, Rashi's in fucking New York breaking in on, like, government spooks and kicking their asses and threatening them to get... It's just... It's insane. Okay, so ultimately, everybody's in Russia, Siberia. They're all trouncing around through the snow. They're all hunting predators. Again, as a reference to Dune, the soldiers have these suits that have this warm water that runs through it, and so that's going to be their advantage against the Soviets, but, you know, they spring a leak, and they end up getting captured, and they're just totally ineffectual, and the only badass is, of course, Schaefer, and we get a few new tools, like this weird fucked-up bear trap made out of little needles. Again, looks like something the Cenobites would use. Schaefer manages to kill yet another predator. Things get more and more hot because the predators have been taking some of the nuclear materials that they've been cannibalizing from the base in order to fix their ship so they get the fuck out of there. And so that whole area is melted from the heat from the nuclear shit. So you'd think that Schaefer and Nikita and the rest of them probably went out like fucking John Wayne after the Conqueror in 10 years from this point. Eventually the U.S. troops, the second group of U.S. troops that Rashi is with, manages to catch up with them and stop Schaefer and Nikita from killing the predators, because they don't want to start any more shit, or they want equipment from them, or I don't know what the fuck. And Schaefer sees Rashi and is just like, what the fuck are you doing here, basically? Christ, Rashi, why thought you could use a hand? Good friends are hard to find. And it's so funny because clearly Schaefer has not thought about Rashi the entire fucking time he's been gone. Means nothing to him, is operating without a thought for this guy. Looking back on this story from a modern context, Rashi's fixation on Schaefer is almost homoerotic. It's just, you know that Rashi is like a Trumpkin or something, because there's no way that someone could have that much passion that's so completely unrequited and yet still maintain that level of devotion without any reward, without any recognition, really. But in the end, Schaefer and Nikita manage to plant a bomb in the spaceship and blow up the predators. The Russians are pissed, the US are pissed, but somehow they don't all end up in a gulag or anything. These comics have no bearing on any kind of reality that we would recognize. Now, the Predator 2 adaptation ran concurrent with the miniseries Big Game. I'm not covering Big Game. I remember seeing issues of Big Game around the time they were coming out, or maybe a little bit afterwards, at least covers of them. I was actually looking forward to reading it because I understood that Evan Dorkin was involved. I assumed that he was going to be the writer on it with some sort of more conventional artist. And then it tripped me out a little bit to find out that he was actually going to be the penciler and that John Arcudi would be writing. And I like John Arcudi's writing, so okay, cool. I could kind of go with that. But then when it actually came time to look at the miniseries, it was maybe, I mean, his credit is penciled by Evan Dorkin, but it's probably more like a layout, or he was just completely overwhelmed by the inker Armando Gill. And there's virtually no Evan Dorkin to be seen here. This is where I sort of hit against the wall, because again, I considered reading this one. Apparently this is a well-received miniseries, but the fact is I don't care about Predators. I never have. The first movie came out in 1987. This was during a period in time where I was living in the desert. The only media that we had access to was a tiny black and white television set. We didn't see any motion pictures the entire time we were out in the desert. We didn't get to watch a ton of television, and it's sort of a blank spot. A lot of stuff that came out in 1987 I just not familiar with because I didn't have a lot of access to it. I saw Lethal Weapon after the fact. Much later I saw Predator. I believe Predator was a rental, a VHS rental, probably 88-89, somewhere in there. Saw the movie. It wasn't as overhyped as a lot of other films that I didn't get to see until video. I saw it. I thought it was fine, but I wasn't blown away by it. I know it's a huge cultural touchstone for a ton of people of my generation. Another person I thought about bringing in for this episode was Mac, because Carl Weathers has been to town a number of times for conventions, and Mac just has a real affection for the "Dylan, you son of a bitch" sequence. Him and Fix It will do that together sometimes, or I think they might have actually tried to do it with Carl Weathers, and even Fryhole's been involved with that at times. Predators are definitely a thing with those guys, and a lot of guys of Generation X vintage. I think the movie's all right. I saw it the one time on VHS. I'd assumed that I'd seen it in the years since then, the 30 some odd years since then. But when I finally decided to rewatch the movie before doing this podcast, it occurred to me that there's no way I had watched this movie from beginning to end in that time period. There's too much stuff that I didn't remember watching in sequence. So what happened is I've seen bits and pieces of this movie over and over again, and there are tons of sequences that are, you know, memed, or that I would come across and watch for a little bit before I lose interest and turn on to something else. So I've seen bits and pieces of the movie many, many times over the years, but as far as beginning to end, like twice. And I like it fine. I have the same problem with it today that I had back in the 80s. To me, the Predators are so clearly derivative of the Aliens that I already been there and I've done that. The basic setup is almost exactly the same as the first Alien movie, but it has all the paramilitary and action stuff from the second Aliens movie. And both Alien and Aliens are considered among the greatest movies of all time. I'm sure there are plenty of people that would be willing to put both of those movies on like a top 100 movies of all time list, right? That's not going to happen with Predator. I think Predator would be a lock for top 100 movies of the 80s, maybe. Top 100 action movies of all time, maybe. But if you really love half of what Predator does, Alien does that better. And if you love the other half, Aliens does it better. To me, Predator feels a little bit redundant and heavily derivative. What's cool about Predator, though, is it's the best G.I. Joe movie. You've got the ultra-masculine, ultra-butch, muscled-up, heavily-armed badasses fighting the revolutionaries in the jungle, and they're fighting the Predator, which gives you that sci-fi element that you also expect from G.I. Joe. Easily the best G.I. Joe movie, and I grew up on G.I. Joe, so that aspect of it I like. It's also one of the reasons why all the Predator movies are disappointing, because unless you're going to get a bunch of fucking alpha male badasses for your sequel, you're going to come up short. And certainly getting leftover, already been killed once Colonial Marines, wannabe Vasquez's, Murtaugh's pretending to be Riggs for your sequel, no, that's not going to work. Adrian Brody ain't going to work. What was it? The Brick Flag? Was he in the Predator? I don't even know. Why didn't they actually get like a Brian Bosworth or you know, bring back Jean-Claude Van Damme? Surely they could have gotten Dolph Lundgren for one of these fucking things, right?
I knew that they had been here before. I know they're coming back.
Find me.
That dry spell Stallone had starting in the late 90s, early 2000s, why not get a Predator movie in there? Why wasn't one of the Expendables prequels them versus the Predator, like they thought about trying to do with the last Rambo movie before they decided to just have him kill a bunch of Mexicans instead? You can experiment with the aliens, because the first Alien movie and the second Alien movie are very, very different, and then you can make your arguments about the qualities of the third and the fourth movies, and there are people who would make a case for Ridley Scott's Prometheus prequels, but the aliens inherently evolve. It's part of the concept that there is this evolution both in the subject and in the movie. The xenomorphs are an elastic enough concept that you can do a lot of different things with them. Predator isn't that. Predator is basically just a ripoff of Alien and Aliens. The thing that makes it different is they have a different alien design, and they are more specifically action movies. Very testosterone-filled action movies. That's the lane. One of the reasons why I think I don't react as strongly to Predator as I do to Alien is I think that the Alien franchise has a very feminine energy, and I think that the Predator franchise has a very masculine energy. Alien can do a lot of different things. Predator needs to keep it simple. Big buff dudes, big fucking blasting guns, violence. I like the inclusion of tits and ass in Predator 2. Gore. One complaint that I think that Roger Ebert had for Predator 2 was that it was not dissimilar from a slasher movie like a Jason Voorhees or Michael Myers, where you've just got these creatures running around and killing everybody. I think that slashers understand their formula, and I think that Predator works better as a slasher movie, but you don't go up against Jamie Lee Curtis. Especially toward the end of Predator 2, it feels a little bit like Danny Glover is the final girl. You know, you gotta have big macho dudes, big weapons. I think you can get more weapons. You can get, you know, if you want to have more of a fair fight with the Predators, then get some attack choppers and tanks and shit involved. You have bigger guns versus more Predators. That's the way that it works, is just more. Just get crazier, just get more violent. I think that's the way you go with Predator. You just go bigger and more ridiculous. I think that a lot of the stuff that bothered me about Verheiden on the Aliens books actually works pretty well with the Predators books. Just go nuts. It's basically a video game. Do that. But having said my piece about the Predator movie, not being a huge fan of that, not wanting to devote any more time than I have to the Predators, since I'm not keen on the concept, this is why there isn't a guest host for this episode, because I had to figure out where is my stopping point with the Predators. How much time do I want to devote to them? Do I want to be alternating episodes of the show to Predator comics? And the fact is, no, I don't. I don't want to read a bunch of Predator shit. I'm not that interested. I don't find the concept that interesting. I'm not a huge fan of some of the books they put out too. I remember Bloody Sands of Time was a book that a guy that I was hanging out with in the early 90s had copies of, and I remember tossing through it and just not being super impressed with it. I think it's about Predators being active in World War I or some stuff like that. It's just not my bag. So while rereading this material, I mostly read it and the Predator Omnibus. And since the Omnibus makes a point of just continuing the Schaefer storyline, it seems to me like that's the best thing for me to do as well. And so that means jumping the timeline to July through October of 1996 for the miniseries Dark River. This is the final Predator book by Mark Verheiden, illustrated again by Ron Randall, this time inked by Rick Magyar. It featured painted covers by Miran Kim. Taking place in real time, it's set in the jungles of South America, August 10th, 1996. And I believe it has a film crew, it's actually CIA agents posing as a film crew are in the stomping grounds of the original Predator movie when they are viciously murdered by a Predator dressed in purple who is working with Amazonian natives who happen to have a video camera and film him killing all these people, even the ones that are unarmed, even the women, so acting against the norm. Then we flash back to New York City, where Schaefer is still a cop. Incredible longevity for such a renegade cop who has gotten up to such nonsense. He's got a new partner who is, in the terminology of the day, a metrosexual. He's a guy who's only concerned about his appearance and looking like a hero cop rather than actually being one. Now, Rashi did not get a lot of affection from Schaefer, virtually none in fact, and that's why it always seemed weird for him to be so pathologically devoted to Schaefer, while Schaefer seemed incapable of any human affection. But it goes to show the difference between the tolerance that Rashi received versus the outright enormous contempt that Schaefer has for his current partner. He jerks this guy around heavily. But anyway, Schaefer gets drawn into the local jail because there's a pilot who claims that he was the guy who airlifted Dutch out of the encampment after the first Predator movie, and that he subsequently showed signs of an alien infection and was put into a quarantine and hadn't been seen since, but that General Phillips would likely know where Dutch is. So based on this premise, Schaefer at gunpoint fights his way out of the jail with the pilot in tow. Once again, they somehow make their way to the South American jungle where, as happened in the first movie, Schaefer ends up teaming up with a local Hispanic guide. The pair of them are forced to work with El Presidente. It turns out what's happened is this is actually the Predator from the first Predator miniseries, the first one that Schaefer had killed, quote unquote. Well, he hadn't actually killed him. He had just injured him grievously, driven him insane. And so now he does not follow the rules of the Predators. He does not have honor anymore. And he just kills whoever the fuck he wants to, whenever he wants to, in part in hopes of attracting Schaefer because he wants revenge. So a bunch of convoluted shit happens. And they do some running man shit where they've got ankle monitors to prevent them from escaping, or they're going to blow up. And so they're fighting El Presidente's men while also still working for him. And then Phillips is involved some way, somehow. And then you got the Amazonian natives. And it turns out that the pilot guy was full of shit. He was just working for Phillips. He doesn't know what happened to Dutch. So the whole thing is premised on bullshit. We're not going to find anything about Dutch we didn't already know. El Presidente had sworn to missile strike any place that the pair got to if they strayed away from his assigned mission path. So they managed to clip on the bracelets to the Predator. And so the Predator gets hit by missiles, and that's the end of the Predator. And then they catch up with Phillips on a golf course, and at gunpoint they vow to get the truth about Dutch, which we're not privy to. Schaefer will appear one more time in a mini, like the last miniseries that Dark Horse ever produces involving the Predators, but I'm not willing to read quite that far into the future. So that's essentially the end of the core Predator lore as written by Mark Verhaeven, in the same manner that he did the Aliens one that we've covered previously. I will have to say that I enjoyed this last miniseries probably the most of the three, essentially because of the inks of Rick Magyar, I believe that. I know that inkers are not usually make or break when it comes to comic projects, but I've always liked his stuff. He particularly did great work over Dennis Cowan on The Question, but he gives the art a real, there's a little bit of Calaisi in there, there's a little bit of Kevin Nolan in there, these all these influences. He makes the Latina character kind of a sex bomb, which is nice. It's just a really attractive and more dramatic looking story, and just smoother, sleeker than the rest of them. The stories are pretty much a mess. The Schaefer character is a dick. This is not material that I would ever read on purpose without there being a motivation to it. And it's probably one of the reasons why I'm not able to compel myself to read anything else for this podcast. But I felt like there needed to be at least one episode to show where the Predator franchise in comics was, should show how it related to Aliens going into the Aliens vs. Predator coverage, which should be in the next episode. Between the Pages blog, bottalk.com, CH, Canoes, Chris A. Field, Otherverse Games, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, Dear Watchers, a Marvel What If podcast, Del Dracula, Doc Strange, Dirk Ashton, Ed Moore, Faro de Alejandria, Franco Benitez, Ghost Hunter the Revenger, The Hammer Strikes, Geeky Stuff and Voiceover, Hello Berlin, History of Comics on Film, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Jack Lausch, James Chase, Jeffrey Brown, They Them, JMT Productions, Keith G. Baker, Kirk Spencer is Spooky and Haunted, Lucretia, Mike at Send Aliens to Me, Nathaniel Gomez, Optic Blasting, Paul K. Bisson, Right Between the Eyes Podcast, Ryan Daly, Sensational Gus, Siskoid, Hashtag Socially Distant, Tomb Price the Pod Crusher, Tora, Oofta, Wayne Burroughs, One Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast. Jeffrey Brown wrote, "The more you talk about this, Frank, it does make me want to read these comics, because I am mostly familiar with the three movies and the AVP Capcom video game and a few random issues of Dark Horse Presents." Fry Hole wrote, "You two rocked it again. Really enjoyed this episode. Plus, we got a mini rant. LOL. Also, totally agree that Sam Keith's drawings of females is way underrated. No giant tits with a 2-inch waist."
This has been a Raw Old Spine podcast. All audio samples are believed covered under fair use laws. No copyright infringement is intended.